much.
Oh, thank you, Mike. I was really glad that Jeff was able to show the diagram of the experiment of energy recovery on the SCA FEL 20 years ago, because with that experiment, Alan Schwetman and Todd Smith set me off on a career which has been a lot of fun, continues to be a lot of fun. I couldn't help but notice that and next to my name on the slide discussing this session, there was a giant aspirin. So the subject of my talk is all the headaches that you're going to have when you try to put a FEL on an URL system. Putting an FEL on an URL changes the dynamics of the situation because you have to do many things to satisfy the FEL that are additional requirements on the URL. And that includes things like longitudinal phase space manipulation, energy stability, phase stability, things like that. And so what I'm going to do is talk about some of those. I realized when I started preparing the talk that this really is more suitable for a one-hour talk. I have a bunch of slides in backup, and if they put those on the web, you can check in many of those areas. So consider this more an introduction to this subject rather than a complete expose of all the issues that are involved. Jeff covered the real question here that you have to deal with, and that is the phase-based manipulation. And that's the thing that causes all these other issues, or many of them, to affect you in the URL. You're starting off with a very long bunch because you want to minimize the higher-order modes, you want to minimize wake fields, and you want to keep the space charge longitudinal energy growth small during the acceleration process. You also want to manipulate the phase space so that you provide a slew in the energy versus time, because you use that then to erect the beam at the FEL, and it comes in with still a fairly small energy spread, but that energy spread grows dramatically after the FEL, and through the use of the transport terms, you then cause another energy phase correlation, which you then have to get all the way back down to your dump. But that large energy spread necessitates the handling of very large energy spreads in your electron beam transport, and that's not easy. If you do it right, however, you can compress the energy spread down to a small amount and recover all of that beam. And you need to recover all of the beam, okay? 10 to the minus 3 loss in a system like this is a disaster. Well, the first thing I want to point out is that your choice of the phases that you're operating out is not a free parameter, because if you look at your energy spread here, if your energy spread gets too large, the recovered beam here has too much energy for the RF system to decelerate, okay? So that in and of itself is a problem, and you have to consider that in the way you set up your dynamics of the system. There's another thing that's going on. Let me use as an example here an acceleration of the beam 10 degrees off RF phase during acceleration, 10 degrees off phase and deceleration, okay? That's before the FEL turns on. Okay, now what happens when the FEL turns on? When the FEL turns on, you end up with, because of, in this example, an M56 of 0.2 meters, a 7.2 degree phase shift of the RF at 1500 megahertz. What does that do? Well, that means that this RF vector down here shifts, okay? And so effectively, your current sum, which starts out here at zero, okay, requiring effectively no RF power except what's required to establish the fields in the cavity, okay, now you're requiring 1.2 milliamps at this 284 degree phase angle. Okay, that's not a nice thing to do to the RF system. For the RF system, it's starting out here at 900 watts, okay, because it's not accelerating effectively any net beam. Okay, but when the FEL turns on, in a time of 10 microseconds, something like that, suddenly the RF system is asked for 7.2 kilowatts, okay, at this phase angle to handle that beam that it sees coming off angle in the recovery. And so that can lead to real issues. Now, as time goes on, you can take this out. You can tune your superconducting cavity, okay, handle the off angle vector here and reduce that down to 2.2 kilowatts, okay, on axis, okay? Now, what happens here, okay, is a complicated thing because potentially you've got serious problems if you're from your RF system. In our case, our klystrons put out 5 kilowatts, okay? You're asking for 7 kilowatts from the tube, okay? It can't give it. What happens? You're still accelerating beam, okay? And so the energy of the accelerator drops, okay? If the energy of the accelerator drops, how does the FVL react? Well, the electron beam no longer becomes erected, okay, at the beginning of the FEL. You don't have as high a peak current. The FEL does not lase as strongly. If the FEL does not lase as strongly, the phase angle by which it shifted now decreases. Okay? When it decreases, it doesn't demand 7 kilowatts anymore. It demands a power level the RF can put out, say 5 kilowatts. Okay? When the RF is putting out this 5 kilowatts, it reestablishes the energy in the accelerator. Okay? And so the FEL starts to lase well again. And now it demands 7 kilowatts again. You can see there's the potential here for a relaxation oscillation unless you design things very well. Okay? As I mentioned, large aspirin is necessary for systems like this. Okay? On a CW basis, life isn't quite so bad. Here's a measure of the RF power demanded by our system. And you can see that instantaneously it may ask for this amount. Okay, this is slightly different parameters than in the previous slide, but it's the same approach. Here, if you allow the cavity time to tune, then the power that's demanded matches what you calculate. And so life gets good there. That's what you need to do, is allow your cavity's time to tune. Providing fast tuning minimizes the demands, but you really can't tune your cavity any faster than acoustic time scales. So, and your FEL operates much faster than that. So your RF system and the dynamics of the rest of your system has to be able to handle those fast fluctuations. Timing jitter, speaking of fast fluctuation, is another issue that you have to worry about. Okay, if you want to hold the stability of your output constant, then you need to keep effectively your detuning length of your optical cavity constant. Now the FEL, okay, if the beam timing is changing slowly, it can compensate for that. The optical cavity will follow the change in arrival time of the electron pulses. But if it happens more rapidly, then effectively, because of the necessity of keeping this optical cavity length constant, that's essentially the dL over L is essentially a d omega over omega, and that ends up with a fairly tight tolerance. In fact, 10% is actually a fairly large peak-to-peak fluctuation for many users. They want it tighter than that. And so you end up with timing jitter constraints, in our case, which are frequency-dependent, but quite tight if you look at high frequencies. And so you need to worry a lot about the stability of your system. And I have in my backup slides, which I can show on the web, a much more careful measure of what that timing jitter is. It's actually difficult to do accurately because you get amplitude to phase conversion and you have to look at high harmonics of your pulse frequency and separate out what the true timing jitter is. We believe we're meeting it, but not by a large factor. Now, Jeff mentioned that you have to control the nonlinearities in the transport. In a recovered system, we have sextuples and octuples to handle nonlinearities and make sure that this large energy spread all gets recovered. The problem is that because of this large energy spread, in our case, a full width of as much as 15% in the electron beam, the nonlinearities can dominate the result. You have to worry about things like power supply stability, the resolution of your power supplies, the magnet reproducibility. If you have a hysteresis program that you use to establish the magnetic field, you have to worry about how well those reestablish the accuracy of your magnetic field. And the magnetic field quality distorts both the transverse and longitudinal phase space. You have to worry about all of those things if you want to recover all of your electrons down at the dump. Now, the thing to worry about here is that the delta B over the dimension of your magnet can result in effectively a change in the path length of the electrons and going through your system, and that then couples through M52 to an energy spread at the dump. If the energy acceptance of your electron beam dump does not handle the energy that you've decelerated to, then you're losing beam there, and at the average currents we're talking about going to, that will lead to burn through of the walls. It turns out, if you go through the analysis of this, the field error integral is independent of the LINAC length and energy gain. That means that the relative field error, the percent of field error that you're allowed, gets tighter and tighter as the electron beam energy goes up. RFEL operates in a LINAC that was designed for 160 MeV, which is fairly modest compared to some of the 600 MeV or higher Earls that people are talking about. That means as you increase these energies, it's going to get tighter and tighter and tighter. And it's not a very loose criteria right now. The energy spread that we're getting at the dump here, you can see we can tolerate about an MeV. So anything more than a part in 1,000 delta B over B is getting a real problem for us. Okay, but if you do it right, you can produce and take out all a very tight electron beam with a narrow bunch, fully erect the electron pulse, take out all the curvature of the RF, produce very narrow pulses. We regularly produce 300 femtosecond full width half maximum electron pulses now. We use this as a diagnostic in our setup every morning when we turn on the machine. And when you laze with that, you end up getting very, very short pulses out of the FEL. Here's a full width half maximum measured by Shukui Zhang at 215 femtoseconds. So it does work, and you can produce the short beam and get that beam down to the dump. Now, we were very careful in our machine to make sure that wake fields didn't bother us during the acceleration, getting it into the FEL. But after the FEL, you have large energy spread. Who cares if you have a little bit of wake field effects on the beam, right? Wrong, okay? Here is a six-way cross, standard vacuum cross, and if you look very carefully, you can see the wiggler chamber actually extends through this cross, so it doesn't even see directly the electron beam. Nonetheless, in putting this short pulse through this six-way cross, it turns out by chance that the cross is resonant very nearly our 1497 megahertz of our accelerator, just by accident. This heats up a lot, okay, and so you have to worry about that. In the FEL, because you're producing very, very short pulses, the situation is a lot worse than in storage rinks. And in the wiggler itself, okay, you have to worry. Again, the wake fields and resistive wall heating in a system like this can be real issues. We have a rather large wiggler chamber, 11 millimeter gap, vacuum gap in our wiggler, which is not a small one by most standards. And despite the fact we were running here with only 4.6 milliamps, you can see on this infrared image the top of this tube is getting very, very hot. Okay, 42 degrees C on the edge here in the center of the top, and when you look at it from the side along the middle. It actually got 100 C in the middle with only 4.6 milliamps of beam going through it. If you're thinking about having a 5 millimeter wiggler gap with these short pulses going through it, you have to think really hard about what you're going to do about that power, how you're going to handle the resistive wall. Okay, so let me just summarize by saying the Earls that we're all planning are very, very exciting. It's a lot of fun to be in the field right now, but they don't. That excitement doesn't come without significant challenges, which we're all going to have to face. And the incorporation of FELs into these Earls adds the list of issues which you have to effectively deal with. The issues become more difficult with the higher charges we're talking about, the shorter pulses, the longer systems, and the higher currents. Higher electron beam energies, and so with that, I will stop and just thank all the members of my team who have been teaching me on a daily basis how to deal with these issues. And I'll stop. Take questions. Thank you.
Thank you, George. Open for questions.
Really must have scared them.
Nobody has a question or a comment on this view? There's one over here. Bill, I think.
For your undulator heating result,
yes.
Is that from, could you basically have calculated that from first principles knowing?
Yeah, that's right.
Was it only a surprise in retrospect? Or?
Yeah, that's right. It's only a surprise in retrospect. I think the thing is that we only really realized that we were really bunching the beam so tightly, and that was leading to these effects. It worked out to be 35 watts per meter for the bunch lengths we were talking about, and it was just the fact, we were not very clever. We didn't either make the tube out of something very conductive, okay, it was out of stainless steel, or coat the inside, which we could have done. And we didn't provide any external cooling to it. So either of those solutions would have dealt with our issues. However, if you're talking about kiloamp peak currents, 100 femtosecond pulses, and 100 milliamp average currents, you've got a lot more cooling, and you want very high conductivity metals in there, and especially if you want to make the gaps a lot narrower. So it will be an issue.
Another question anywhere?
Okay.
It seems not, so let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you,
George.